tonight on Arena. We listen to Lady Gaga's Mayhem and Get Millie Black, Fear and Toward Zero are our TV reviews. As it's Friday, it's TV review night. We begin with Agatha Christie, dragged from her staple afternoon TV slot to primetime in Toward Zero, a new three-parter on BBC One. Angelica Houston, Clark Peters and Matthew Rhys lead the cast that includes our own Ella Lily Highland as the spurned ex-wife of a famous tennis star, part of a love triangle that's bound to end in murder. For Genteel Devon, to the streets of Kingston, Jamaica next with Get Millie Black on Channel 4. Tamara Lawrence plays the title role, a detective with a blunt attitude and a difficult past. In a series written by the Booker Prize winning author of A Brief History of Seven Killings, Marlon James. Finally, Fear on Prime Video. Martin Compson and Anjali Mohendra play Martin and Rebecca, a couple who move into their dream home in Glasgow, only to find that their world is threatened by a creepy neighbour, Jan, played by Sally MacLeod, living in their basement. Jen Gannon and Declan Burke have been watching all three and join me now in studio. So Jen, as ever Agatha Christie, there is no shortage of characters to keep us occupied. Tell us about some of the key figures in Toward Zero on BBC.
So I mean, the thing about Toward Zero is I think, like Rachel Bennett, it was very fortuitous when they chose Toward Zero to adapt, because there is that kind of shades of two zeitgeisty films. It's a bit challengers. You've got a tennis love triangle, and then you've also got the big house drama of something like Saltburn. So I can see where they were trying to go with modernising Agatha Christie in that way. But it is a strict mystery whodunit tale, and you have this slick Brit tennis star Neville Strange, and he's played by Oliver Jackson Cohen. And when we meet him, he's in the middle of this love triangle between his ex-wife Audrey, who's the Irish actress Ellie Lila Highland, who we last saw in Black Doves. And we first meet them, they're in court, she's suing for divorce because he has this other woman who is now going to be his new wife, Kay. She's played by Mimi Keen, and for some unknown reason Neville suggests that they all bunk up in his childhood home in Gulls Point in the Devonshire coast, and it kind of does feel inexplicable, but I guess you have to get
and
everyone
the new love
out.
Kay is happy.
She's not greatly happy by this. No, as you would be. Like, I mean, that's realistic at least. But so that stately home it belongs to is Aunt Lady Tresellian, who's played by Angelica Houston, who is in delightful battle axe form, is what I would say. And she spends most of her days holed up in bed, but has this telescopic lens, like literally, on the goings on of everyone, including the residents of this new racy pleasure hotel, the Easterhead Bay, which is across the bay from her house. So she has this companion who's pretty much a doormat, Mary, and she keeps her up to date with the goings on and the gossip, but she wants everybody to, you know, convene in the house to get all the news from people.
Okay, well, we have a clip from with the self-mentioned, pre-mentioned battle axe. Angelica Houston, who plays Lady Tresillian, is none too impressed when the high-profile divorce of her nephew, who is the tennis star, played by, his name is Neville Strange, and he's played by Oliver Jackson Cohen, and his wife Audrey, played by the Irish Ella Lily Highland. The other voice you'll hear is the aforementioned doormat Anjan Vasan as Lady Tresellian's maid Mary.
Oh, Audrey. The humiliation. The public humiliation of it all.
She asked for it. I said they will strip you bare. But Audrey will never be told. That girl. Heart and stomach of a king. Neville has never been a cad. He was always devoted to Audrey. It's impossible. Absurd that he should throw his reputation away for this Venus flytrap.
Well, they call her a wildcat. They say she shot a man.
Stop reading those rags, Mary.
there, Angelica Houston there from Towards Zero. Declan, unusually, no one dies in the first episode. I kept waiting for the murder, but murder came there none.
that's the reverse of a spoiler, Kay.
But this follows Agatha Christie because she was playing with the convention.
Yes, every now and again, Agatha Christie would write an experimental novel that kind of turned the conventions of the traditional whodunit on its head. Who Killed Roger Ackroyd, probably the best example, or even, you know, Murder on the Orient Express. So with this, it actually opens with Lady Tressilian's lawyer, Treves, who's played by Clark Peters. So he informs all and sundry that the most interesting thing about a murder is that the murder is the climax. And what if you can go back and find point zero, which is when the very, very first seeds of whatever happened to be the sexual jealousy or the power grab or the greed or whatever happens to be, and then identify that, then you can follow the story the whole way through to the point where the dramatic murder occurs. And that's a very interesting concept in the confines of a crime fiction novel, particularly.
And this
like
is
Agatha
said
Christie,
by one of the characters
by,
in it.
Absolutely, at the start, and then is repeated in the second episode. But in practice, as a TV drama narrative, it means that there's an awful lot of foreshadowing for starters, but also kind of throwing back and looking at what happened before all the main characters gathered in the stately home, which is very traditional for an Agatha Christie story. And as Jen said, there's a lot of characters here. And that's generally not a problem. There usually isn't an Agatha Christie story because we need a lot of suspects, but they need something to do.
Right.
They need something interesting to say. And we heard a couple of lines from Angelica Houston. She gets about three juicy lines. And that's about it.
Right. There is the detective as well,
oh,
Jen.
Is.
And
yeah.
This is played by Matthew Rhys. And he's having good fun.
He
if
really
nobody
is.
Else is.
I mean, he really is. And I actually wish they had dispensed with most of the plot just to concentrate on Matthew Rhys's absolutely tormented detective, because he is this grey-faced former soldier, Inspector Leach, and he is suffering from a deep depression, put it that way. And you can just get lost in watching him getting slowly sozzled in the hotel bar and trying to like drown out his post-war PTSD. And that's a show in itself. Like, and we've seen Matthew Rhys kind of do that before with Perry Mason, and how good he is at that. He's just so good at that depth of character, but they don't give him enough to do in another way as well. And I wanted to keep kind of watching what his character would do without the rubrics of this very dreary whodunit around it. I mean, I think he does bring the show into another dimension, but it's not enough to save it as a storyline, because a lot of it is, like you were saying, Declan was saying, it is this backstory and it lingers. And the lingering is usually concentrated on shots of people across a dinner table staring at each other in silence or looking into the middle distance. And it kind of reminded me of like a Victoria Wood sketch about the creakiness of, like, you know, period dramas. I was like, what is this? And I know they're trying to inflect it with this modern sensibility, because they're trying to say, you know, this is not your granny's Agatha Christie, because they throw in a few graphic sex scenes in
yeah.
it.
But that is not your granny's Agatha Christie. I never saw that in the afternoon.
Kind of laughable. There's one that takes place on the stairs between Audrey, the ex-wife, and Neville, her supposed ex-husband, where for all the world, it looks like he's doing a complicated lift on Strictly. Like, it's bizarre. And it kind of, it takes you out of the story even, because you feel that this is lip service. It's just trying to push the boundaries a little bit and excuse it for being on at 9 p.m.
Now, there's an awful lot of setup, as you were saying, mainly in episode one. Does it crank up in episode two?
Well, I mean, a murder occurs.
Oh,
in episode two. You would be relieved to hear, and we won't say who, not to give too many spoilers, but it doesn't really. I mean, having established that,
so it doesn't compare with those ones that are usually shown around Christmas. One had John Malkovich in it, you know, and another Aidan Turner, I think. You know, then there was none. You know, where they really try and play with the Agatha Christie, you know, even stylistically.
Not really. I will give them credit for this. They have stayed fairly close to the source material. And they get credit for that. But as I said, does that make great TV narrative? No, it doesn't, because you're asking me about the second episode. Apart from the big murder that occurs, we get more of the same. It's all about establishing character largely by way of, you know, backdrop and explaining motive and so forth. And it's not very interesting.
Even with Matthew Rhys.
Even with Matthew. And Jack Farthing, who I always say is a great
Jack
actor.
Farthing, who people would know as the bad guy in Poldark.
Poldark, yeah. And I think post-Poldark, his greatest role has been in Rain Dogs, and people really need to give him more to do because he is a superb actor. I want to see him in Industry. He'd be a great financial terrorist in Industry, I'm sure. But he's here as this cousin, this black sheep of the family that comes back and is trying to squeeze some money out of his aunt before she, you know, wants to be put into the will, basically. He's a bit weak, like, as in the character, but he there's something about him that, I don't want to give any spoilers, but there is an incident between him and Neville that happened in his childhood, and it was like he had to cover for the golden boy. So he's full of resentment and bitterness. And he's also stringing the Mary along as well, writing her letters, saying
the doormat.
Yes, exactly. Yes. So, I mean, he's there, he's good. It's unfortunate because there are so many good actors in this that it's just not enough, that it amounts to kind of nothing, really. It's a wasted opportunity, I really feel.
Stars out of five for Towards Zero from you, Jen.
Two.
Oh God, and from you, Declan.
Yeah, I would agree. Very sluggishly paced, and that implausibility that Jen talks about the love triangle that all comes. No, I just couldn't get past that. I'm afraid two stars for me as well.
So I think episode two is coming up on BBC, BBC Two on Sunday. Now, Get Millie Black. Declan, Jamaican author Marlon James, who won the Booker, as I said, for A Brief History of Seven Killings. What story is he telling in Get Millie Black?
Right from the get-go, this is at the other end of the spectrum to Towards Zero. So Millie Black, we get a short synopsis of her early life. Beloved brother, Orville, who is tormented by his mother, who's a bit of a religious bigot, certainly a very conservative. And when he starts displaying, shall we say, effeminate characteristics, he gets badly beaten and so forth. When Millie stands up for him, she gets sent to the UK. So the story really starts with Millie. And in the interim, she has heard that Orville, who is now Hibiscus, is a transgender woman, that he has died. And she's devastated in the UK. She has joined the police and has now arrived back in Jamaica, where she discovered, this is all in the first 10 minutes, this is not spoilers, Hibiscus is still alive and well.
Living in a place called the Gully.
The Gully, which he is living as a sex worker. It's in I mean, they're very quite hard-hitting about the reality of homophobia, about attitudes towards sex workers, and in some cases brutal. So this is by no means, we're not talking about Death in Paradise as a Caribbean crime drama here. This is quite authentic, it felt to me, and particularly the character of Millie Black, who gets that lovely crime narrative convention of being the outsider with the insider's eye. She straddles both cultures, and sometimes you hear her speaking in an English accent to her colleagues, but when she's interviewing suspects, she drops into the Jamaican patois, and that tells us that she's quite a complex character right from the get-go.
So as Declan says, that is the backstory of Millie Black. But tell us then about, she is in Jamaica to solve a crime. What is that crime?
Part of this is the fact that she has this unbelievable guilt for leaving Hibiscus behind, and wants to save children. And there is a case where there's a missing case of a young teenage girl, a very impressionable teenager who seems to have been groomed by the son of this very influential white family, and they're on her radar to try and unpick this mystery. So it's Freddie Somerville, he's involved with this teenager called Janet, and they have this very strange relationship, but there is a wider hunt for Freddie because he's involved with a crime unit, a syndicate in the UK, where travels over to team up with Millie find Freddie.
We'll talk about that in a second. Let's just listen to this scene where Detective Millie, played by Tamara Lawrence, and Curtis, her sidekick, played by Gershwin Eustace Jr., pay a visit to the wealthy parents of the chief suspect, who is Freddie Somerville. Paul Isa plays the dad, Leddick.
Police business and party business no mix. Maybe pop back later,
Later won't cut it.
Freddie is connected to a girl gone missing, Mr. Somerville.
Freddie? You're looking for Freddie and you come uptown? Best bet is him slumming somewhere with some ghetto trash.
Well, the ghetto trash he's slumming with has gone missing.
Your superiors know that you're out here harassing good people. One call, you know, and I'll...
Get your face in a mugshot.
You trespassing. Heywood!
Need security to escort you?
Declan, that is a very good scene from Get Millie Black there, because a lot of the themes you hear about uptown, which is where the rich people live. We've heard already about the gully, which is the worst place you could live in town. And then you get that idea of the superiority of the white skins even over the black police force.
Yeah, and in a certain sense, what Get Millie Black does, and even the title alludes to Get Carter, that the very famous film where Michael Caine character returns to his native Northeast and so forth, only to find himself a fish out of water. But what it does is it has the framework of the classic crime narrative, in which all aspects of society are drawn into a single crime. What I think elevates it above most of them is how well it portrays Jamaica, the culture, I've used the word authentic already. So this is not a world of palm trees and white beaches. This is a world of back alleyways, ghettos, the gully you mentioned, particularly grim experience. So it has blended the both, and it makes no concession really to the viewer. I mean, there were times when I could have done with subtitles when some of the Jamaican characters were speaking to one another. But I kind of liked that. It's up to me to catch up.
That's right, because Millie Black, it changes the way she speaks depending on who she's talking
to.
Yeah,
there's a lot about code switching and how to survive. And she's had to be tough because, you know, she was sent to London as a young teenage girl, and she's scrappy and she knows how to communicate with people and get to the roots of issues. But it's all about playing with images, like ideas of duality, because her partner Curtis, he's a closeted gay man, and under like this very homophobic, you know, society that they're living in, and his partner Daniel is tired of this, is tired of living as a second class citizen. And there's a lot in it about who we are in relation to other people, because then you have, as I said, Joe Dempsey comes in playing this other detective from Scotland Yard who wants to investigate Freddie Somerville, and the racial tensions between him and Millie, but also between the Somerville family and Millie. They all kind of play out, they all mirror each other. And I think,
so what's the attitude of the British cop? Because was a British cop at one stage.
It's very
well.
Mansplainy, which was great, and I think Joe Dempsey does that really well. He's very condescending towards her, but you can see that there's a wryness, a sparkiness to their kind of coupling being thrown together on this case, and they want to get the better of each other, but you're never quite sure of each other's footing, and they're very suspect of each other. But I think is so good about it is every episode a new person narrates it, so you're getting this texture. There's more context there because their competing points of view add layers and layers to the story, and I think that's quite brilliant. It's very novelistic in that way, and it's a really good way to get you into the story because it's quite complicated and there's a lot going on, but you never lose the threads.
Oh right, because I saw the first episode, so it's Millie
Hibiscus, and then it moves on, you know, as you go on each, so it goes to the end, I think it's with Curtis, but you're getting every single, you're getting a different narration, you're getting a different point of view, which is so clever and works really well.
Overall, Declan, did you like it?
I thought it was terrific. Kay, performances, we haven't really mentioned Gershon Eustace as the partner cop. He's terrific. And China McQueen, we didn't give her enough time. Yeah. She is brilliant in that role. And Tamara Lawrence is terrific.
Anyway, She plays Hibiscus.
Story's terrific. Characters are terrific. Acting is great. Scenario is great. You know, really, really strong 4 stars. They're already talking about bringing back a new series. And I'd be really looking forward to that.
And you, Jen?
I loved the sisterhood. I loved, you know, Millie and Hibiscus and those scenes together where they're all grappling with ghosts, the ghosts in their lives, the ghost of their mother.
Yeah, I think you were saying, you know, you can't get the past back. But yeah. Millie, in some ways, wants to
she
be
wants
the
everything.
Big sister.
She wants to protect Hibiscus now like she didn't, you know, in the past. But you can't get those days back. And Hibiscus wants to move to the future and move on. And there's this kind of brilliant connection with them in those scenes. And I think it's so powerful and emotional and effective to watch the two sisters together and how the dynamic has changed in their lives. And so I think, you know, outside of it being a great gripping crime drama, there's a depth to it that's absolutely so rewarding. So,
and from you, stars out of five?
4 out of 5, because it ratchets it up its OTT nature. And that's the only reason why I would like just give that one minus.
Okay, so that's Get Millie Black, and that's on Channel 4. We have one more show to listen to and talk about, and we'll do that after the break. It's Friday night and it's TV review time with Jen Gannon and Declan Burke. We've been talking about Towards Zero on BBC and Get Millie Black on Channel 4. And now, Jen, finally, we're going to Glasgow and Fear, a new drama of There's a Weirdo in the Basement variety. A well-to-do young family in a new dream home. What's the setup?
It's pretty much like a straight down the line kind of Pacific Heights. If you remember that, Neighbour from Hell fable.
Who you can't get rid of.
Yes, yes, exactly. So it follows Martin, who's played by Martin Compston from Line of Duty, and his wife Rebecca, who's Anjali Mohindra, who actually is in Get Millie Black as well, weirdly enough. She's having a good week. They're parents to two young children, and they move from London to Glasgow because they have this dream home that Martin wants to get back to Scotland. And he has big plans for this enormous townhouse, which has the thinnest walls and the most noisy floorboards you're ever going to encounter. And party to all these creaks and thumps is their downstairs neighbour, Jan, played by Solly McLeod. And he rents the basement flat. And he at first seems kind of welcoming, offering like the kids homemade pizza, friendly, but maybe a nervous kind of loner who lives directly under their house. What could go wrong? Well, everything, because, you know, Fear is only 3 episodes long, so they're really trying to cram everything into this. So Jan is your typical basement kind of dwelling incel. His house is like full of old arcade games, and he has this unbelievable IT setup that is kind of reminiscent of the Sharon Stone thriller Sliver, where Billy Baldwin's character had like
the
TVs. So they were like kind of trained on, you know, every move of Sharon Stone's character. That's what's going on here. So things take a really dark turn where Jan kind of makes an awkward move on Rebecca talking about her underwear, and then writes her a very explicit card. When then Martin goes to confront him, it would seem that somehow, we don't know, it's never explained, he has managed to hack into all of their IT, like all of their laptops, their phones, but also even their kids' little robots. So we don't know how this has happened, but Jan is watching their every move now.
Now, rewind a little bit to the more innocent time when Rebecca Anjali Mohindra gets to know her new neighbour, Jan, played by Solly McLeod, over lunch.
So are you from Glasgow?
But I was adopted, so I don't know. But I grew up in Campbelltown, near the bottom of Kintyre.
I went to Inverary once.
Yeah, a few hours on from that. It's at the end of the road to nowhere. Makes you feel trapped.
So how did you leave? When did you leave?
It took a while. I mean, I wanted away from when I was, I don't know, not even 10. Well, I mean, where'd you go at that age?
My mum was a single mum, and I'm an only child. And when she died, I realised I felt no ties to where I grew up, to anywhere. It's a strange feeling. But this is home now.
We did all fear she was oversharing in that chat. Declan, there's more to Martin. This is the Martin Compton character who wasn't in that clip than meets the eye. We get a little bit of backstory on him, which shows he might have slight issues around, you know,
weapons.
Yeah,
and credit to the program makers. They build that into it. We're not talking about flashbacks or anything like that. So he is ostensibly a successful architect. He has put in a major commission designing the new art centre in Glasgow and so forth, and he seems to be the front runner. So this, everything is going really well when they first arrive. We do get a hint that there might be a tiny temper issue with one short scene, and we're thinking, oh, okay, well, everybody's due a bad day and so forth. But we do realise as the first episode proceeds that he hasn't been completely honest with Rebecca about how secure their financial future is and so forth. So when things do start to go a little bit wrong with Jan, downstairs, he, you know, it's a very short fuse that he has.
Yes, he has a bad day at the office and then he takes it out on Jan, who has been misbehaving with his wife, as in getting a bit too friendly.
Yeah, and they kind of are kind of polar opposites, because we're also learning there's a bit more to Jan. He's not simply, as Jen says, this, you know, basement-dwelling incel kind of geezer. He makes an accusation against Rebecca and Martin, effectively saying that they're abusing their children. He reports them to the police. But it's not just a mischievous or a malicious report. We realise he genuinely fears for these children's safety. And then we start to wonder why, and to the extent that his own experience in his life, and we heard from the clip that you played, there's kind of not an ideal childhood. How much, to what extent rather, is that playing into his fears for the children and so forth? There's no doubt by the end of the second episode, he is genuine.
Now, that sounds pretty rich in terms of the backstory and how that affects the relationships on screen.
Yeah, I didn't get that from it myself. I actually thought that the character of Jan was very underwritten. I thought, like, by the end of the whole situation, you're kind of left wondering, going, well, actually, that was amped up. Because it's only three episodes, usually I complain if something is, you know, longer than five episodes, but, like, because it is only three episodes, you don't get that necessary build up, and I think it needs to be tight because it's like one of those pot boiler, you know, thriller, but it's not chilling enough in one way. You're always, the minute you see him, you're like, okay, this guy is strange. The end. We know what's going to happen. There's no build up there. It's amped up. And it's on this same level for the whole three episodes, where it is just this crescendo of fear and fight backs. And there is a bizarre plot line where Martin reports the accusations to social services himself. Like, why would you do that? No one would do that. I thought that was a very strange plot point to have in it. The only reason it's there is because to make the accusation stick later on. But it just felt really bad writing to me. I mean, the issue I think for me with it is everything is so clearly telegraphed. It feels like you're being sledgehammered into submission with neon signposts. Like, who cares about subtext? You know what I mean? There's no nuance here because
I think got a bit more subtext than you did from it, Jan.
I think what fascinated me about it less, and I do think, no, Jen is absolutely right, mm-hmm. that, you know, it kind of hits the ground running, mm-hmm. and, you know, it goes bad in two ways, slowly at first and then very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. What I found particularly fascinating, and I think other people might too, is how helpless Martin and Rebecca are in terms of the law, either in relation to the police or when they go to a solicitor and say, what can we do with this situation? And they say, nothing. He hasn't committed a crime. He's actually a good citizen. He's doing so. No matter what he does, it seems that they're relatively, their hands are tied. And it's that sense of being, that helplessness, even though you know there's a maliciousness coming at you and that at any point it can escalate to something far more serious. I think that's an interesting, maybe the only kind of subtext that there is.
And Jen,
perhaps,
in terms of performances then, those three key characters,
I thought they were all actually really well done. Like, I think Martin Compton's great and he's really good at being that kind of, like you said, he's a bit of a live wire, he's a bit of a have-a-go hero, and you get that aggression from him that's kind of tightly wound up. And, I do think, you know, Anjalee Mohindra is good as well at being like somebody who wants to make a good impression and be welcoming, but then also, you know, fears that she's given away too much and then she's being walked over and then is terrified.
And the man
what's
downstairs?
I think he's very good. Like, Solly McLeod is very good at something that I don't think is built up enough. It's not well written enough. And I think that's the problem. You only had three episodes, so it's not enough time to flesh out these characters, especially, you know, the family, Martin's family, because they're in it as well. And his father, who's played by James Cosmo, is this very overbearing figure. And you want to find out more about them. You want to understand the dynamics between his father, his brother, and his sister that died as well. And you just don't get enough time for that. So when it ends in this very bizarre ending, I thought, it kind of felt silly. The payoff to me felt quite silly at the end.
All right, stars out of five from you, Jen.
I give it a two.
Two out of five from you and from you, Declan.
I was intrigued by that whole legal quagmire paralysis thing. I thought it was strongly acted. It's a four stars from me.
So four and two out of five. And that's for Fear, and Fear is on Prime Video. Get Millie Black is on Channel 4, and Towards Zero is on BBC One. Jen Gannon and Declan Burke, thank you so much. More reviews now. It's time for albums. Lady Gaga returns with Mayhem, her seventh studio album, a fusion of industrial pop and electronic beats, marking a shift back to her dance pop roots while embracing darker, more introspective themes. Donegal alt folk artist Ramper makes his solo debut in Loner, a deeply personal and atmospheric record that reflects on rural life, fading traditions and the passing of time. And veteran rocker Bob Mould delivers Here We Go Crazy, his 15th solo album, refining his signature guitar-driven sound while exploring themes of control, chaos and resilience. I'm joined now by Aoife Barry and Owen Glacken, who've been listening to all three albums. Let's start with Lady Gaga's Mayhem. This is Disease. That's Disease from Mayhem, Lady Gaga's new album. Aoife, Mayhem has been described as a return to Gaga's dance pop roots. She's been off the dance floor for a while, hasn't she?
She has. She's a very busy woman. It feels like she's kind of never away because of the fact she's on the big screen a lot. You know, people will possibly have seen her in Folie à Deux last year as well, and she was in the third remake of A Star Is Born. I mean, an amazing film. She's brilliant in that. She's someone who has really broadened out her career in the last number of years, and she's someone who always really, really was determined to be famous and to show off her talents. She's super talented as well as someone who wanted to be famous. So yeah, it's good to hear her back in album form on Mayhem. This is a really interesting record because, as you kind of said there at the top of the show, you know, she's returning a lot to her roots, and I think she's kind of almost like planting a flag in the ground and saying like, I did this, I created this, you know, Bad Romance, you know, Poker Face, these sort of tracks, I'm the iconic person behind them, and you know, listen to me. And she's indicating as much as that in interviews around this record as well too, that you know, she's kind of talking about how sometimes people undermine female musicians and say that they didn't create their own sound, that they have nothing to do with it necessarily, and that is something that has been thrown at a lot of female pop and rock stars. And she's saying, this is me and I did it. It's very, very big, loud album for about three quarters of it, and I'm sure it actually sounded probably really great on the radio there, but in some circumstances, if you're like playing it off your phone or you're at home and you want to chill, it's maybe not the album. If you want to be on a dance floor, I think it would sound absolutely great. But that intensity of energy can get a little bit wearing, I think, by the time you get to the slower moments of the record towards the end.
Owen, some awful realisation came to you while you were listening to the album, something about her vowels.
Well, she does have this thing, and I don't want to harp on about it, but she has this technique, and it's not my place to tell her it doesn't work, because quite clearly it does. She's a very, very, very successful and incredible artist. But she does this thing where she takes whatever the title of the song is, she takes the broad vowel sound and repeats it. And it's in across her work, and it's, you know, Roma, Roma, Ma, from yeah. Romance, Judah, Judah, da, 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 from yeah. Judas. And one of the better examples of it in my book is the Shalala, Shalala, Lalo from Shallow. And it's littered across her work.
And you don't like it?
It's sometimes it grates me a lot, yeah. And I know I'm being nitpicky here. And then when the album started to release the first few singles, there was a song called Abracadabra. And I thought, well, she's kept that in the back pocket. She's had that in the back pocket for a rainy day.
And she do a lot of
yeah, and then we go Abracadabra, Amor, Unana, Abracadabra, Morta, Ugaga, and so on and so on and so on.
And then the next song,
she takes us to Garden of Eden, you know. No, it's across the record. I'm not going to nitpick. It's just one of those things that bugs me a little bit. But you know, as we've said, it's a return to what she's known for. When you think of Lady Gaga, this is the kind of music you think of. It's strong. It's bold. It's brash. She brings in new elements. You know, there was always a sort of an industrial sort of energy to some of her stuff before, and she draws that out really well here. It's quite exciting. Again, the track listing's a little bit all over the shop in that. the lighter moments come at the end, and they kind of feel like they should have been sprinkled through, you know, a little bit more throughout to kind of give it a little bit more balance. But that's just my book.
Aoife, she's in a happy place now. She has her boyfriend, who is her co-producer, I think, on this album.
Yes.
And she was talking in interviews today that, you know, she... things are pretty good for her.
Yeah, it's really nice to see that. I think her fans probably really welcome it, because she's, you know, talked about the tougher times that she's had, and she's reflected on difficult times. And her fiance Michael Polanski was one of the co-producers alongside Gaga and Andrew Watt. And she's talked about how, you know, like you're saying there, she's written the albums from some of the best songs she can remember from a place of happiness. And this, you know, that really does come across. You know, she also said that the album started as her facing her fear of returning to the pop music that her earliest fans loved. So I thought that was interesting too. I mean, one thing that I thought was interesting is the track Blade of Grass, which is towards the end. And like Ona is saying there, the songs towards the end are more ballads. Blade of Grass is this beautiful ballad, apparently about her relationship with her fiance. And her vocals on it are amazing. And it's at that moment that you think, oh God, I haven't, the whole album, it takes till now to realise, you know, the Gaga vocals kind of getting that moment in the spotlight. And I do agree that it would have been nice to have those lighter songs mixed in, you know, throughout, rather than waiting for the very end. And it also ends with her duet with Bruno Mars, which has been in the charts for already. It's got 2 billion streams on Spotify. And that feels like a really strange song to end with, because Bruno Mars takes the lead vocals on that. So you don't really get her. She doesn't really get to shine as much. So it's a kind of a funny record in many ways.
Now, not everything is perfect in her life, as the song Perfect Celebrity tells us. Some good lyrics there. Sit in the front row, watch the princess die.
Yeah, you know, we were both chatting there during the song about how it ties in with a lot of themes of kind of artists like Chappell Roan talking about fame, and Owen was talking about the film The Substance as well, that echoes those kind of themes of fame and celebrity.
That's it. I kind of felt, listening to that song, it's like, well, part of me was going, well, we've been here before with Gaga as early as 2008, 2009 with the Fame, and then that reissued version of it with kind of more tracks, the Fame Monster. We've gone through this theme with her before, but then, as we're just saying, it does feel fresh again. I'm thinking of Millie Bobby Brown with her video calling out people for kind of treating her quite poorly, and we are still in that same place. And again, that line, sit in the front row and watch the princess die, could have come straight from the Substance screenplay. You
absolutely
know?
Yeah. So stars out of 5 from you, Owen.
I'll give it a 3.
3 from you, and from you, Aoife.
Yeah, I liked, like, you know, the Prince influenced Killer, and I liked, you know, the song Zombie Boy, but I'd give it 3 as well overall.
3. So that's for Lady Gaga's Mayhem. So Ramper, he's Owen, a loner from Belfast. He's written and performed this whole album alone.
I think I best correct you there. I think he's a Donegal man.
What did I say he was?
You said he's Belfast.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I didn't know he was Donegal. Yes.
The amount of cups of tea that just got dropped in the county of Donegal, I tell you. You know.
Wash my mouth out.
So he's sort of an indie darling already, with his work in their thousands, who are a much beloved kind of outfit from Donegal. And he's gone solo. And I mean, I don't know where to start with this album, other to say I loved it. There's a sort of a medicinal quality to this music that I wasn't expecting. And there was a sort of a synchronicity, because when I sat down to listen to this, I just dealt with a really, really nasty punami from a very, very resistant toddler. And I was very stressed and my neck was up here. And then I sat down, and within seconds, my shoulders dropped and I just took a deep breath and I got lost in this music. And then when you read the press release, he talks about how he recorded this album in just the stolen moments between, well, his own kids were napping. And I thought, I get it, pal. I'm with you. But anyway, back to the music. Excuse me. You can tell it's recorded on his own in that it's all very sparse, lovely layered textured guitars. He's a muso. He's a session player. He's a road dog. You know, he's been around a long time, and he leans into what he's good at, which is lovely strings, as in guitar strings, lap steel, some gentle piano, and he just creates these lovely, lovely beds for these gorgeous stories and these songs and these characters to come to life.
Yes, yes, because remember, he's done this on his own, so what you're going to hear in this Pale as the Moon is overlayering of his own voice.
Like snow that's melting,
There we go with Ramper, and that's Pale as the Moon from his solo album Loner. I don't know if we said, Aoife, his name is Declan McLafferty. Yeah. He's a well-known session musician.
Yeah, he's played with the likes of Paul Brady and Tony Tyrrell, and he's someone who's clearly a really talented musician. And the fact that he's able to make this record on his own and make it sound like that. And when I first listened to it, I immediately thought of the first time I heard Bon Iver all those years ago. Yeah. And he really has that sound to him. Really vocally sounds a little bit like Andy Schauf, who's a little less well known here in Ireland, but it's incredible. If you like the sound of this, check out Andy Schauf. Sigur Rós and Elliot Smith, particularly with that, like, you know, when he probably didn't use a four track, he used, I'm sure, a laptop, but like that idea of multi tracked vocals and harmonies are so beautiful. And what I really like too is that you have different kind of phases or styles of music. So you have that kind of really Sigur Rós nostalgic kind of bigger music sound, and then you have more kind of folky finger picked tracks. You even have a song called Don't Forget to Look Up that sounded to me like Siamese Dream era Smashing Pumpkins. So you've got a lot of his influences coming out there as well too. You know, it's very simple in many ways, and yet it's actually really got so much going on with it. I mean, even lyrically, you know, there's a beautiful image, cigarettes on a tray, I think is what he says in the song Eyes, and you think, wow, like the lyrics are really thought through and they're really telling you something. He covers things about, you know, depression, about moving to Brighton for college and the culture shock around that, the death of Irish traditions, you know, rural living. There's a real sense of location and geography in it as well too. I was so surprised in a really excited way when I heard this record. It's really, really beautiful.
Yes, Owen, we're going to play a little bit of Mothers now. I think that really got you.
Yeah, that was a song, Mothers and Eyes, two songs in particular, but Mothers, the song had ended and I realised I was crying and I didn't even know when I started. Aww. But honest to God, it's that kind of music.
Yeah.
It really hit me right in the stomach, I have to say.
And I guess that he's done it all himself. So he feels, was it you were saying, if you closed your eyes, you'd feel he was beside you on
that's
the
thing. That's what it felt like. It felt like to me, you know, if you close your eyes, it's like your mate sitting on the couch playing you his new song, almost. It's that sort of a real intimate
okay.
feel.
Well, let's listen to some of Mothers. I can see how he got you sobbing.
I'm telling you. That was, and now I remember that was the line. It was the line about the empty seat at the table, a hard lesson. That just got me right in the feels. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So should we go on to Stars? Stars out of five from you, Owen.
I loved it. I really did. And even his voice, that gorgeous Donegal lilt. We need more Donegal accents in media and in music and in the world. More Donegal, up Donegal. Jamie's winning matches. 4.5 stars, please.
4.5 stars. Yeah. Very good. And from you, Aoife.
Yeah, I give it 4 stars. A really solid 4 stars. It's a really, really lovely record. It could be, you know, nominated for the choice maybe next year.
It'd be well deserving if so, yeah.
Now, Bob Mould, who is he, Aoife?
He is a very iconic rock musician. If anybody's heard of the band, if they're into rock, they will have it. Maybe some people haven't. The band Husker Du, a great name. I think it's a Swedish-Danish saying. He was in that band. They released around, I think, about 3 albums. They had a really famous album called Zen Arcade. And they were around in, you know, the 90s at a time when you had the kind of college rock scene, hardcore scene in particular, kind of, you know, post-punk, punk scenes going on. And they were, you know, among those big groups, those groups of young guys making really kind of rapid fire rock music in an era that really changed music. And you think of bands like Black Flag and the Dead Kennedys, they would have been associated with them as well too. And he was a member of the band. They kind of imploded for sad reasons after a few albums, and two of the members went to do their own thing, and he formed a band called Sugar in the 90s that were going for a while, and since then he's been doing his own solo thing. So this is his 15th record. So this is a guy who is 64 years old, steeped in rock music, had a huge impact on it, and is the kind of guy who's in a band that actually influenced other bands like the Pixies and Green Day. So if you're influencing them, you're doing something really important in music.
Okay, so let's listen to the title track. This is Here We Go Crazy.
Way up on the mountain, trees blowing the breeze.
Bob Mould there with the title track, Here We Go Crazy. So he's obviously still rocking, Owen. So is this vintage Bob Mould, or do you see progression here?
Well, this is the thing. His work with Husker Du, I'm aware of. This is his 15th solo album. And let's just put it mildly, I have some gaps to fill in myself. I mean, the guy's career has gone on and on and on, and he's so prolific. So I can't even tell you if this is
fair enough
standing out. I just know that I love it. And that opening song, Here We Go Crazy, it's like a thoroughly enjoyable punch in the face of an opening track. And it sets that bar and it just keeps going. I think it's the fourth song, what's it called? Hard to Get, where there's this brief little drop in the dynamics. And when it happens, you feel like you're getting your head above the water for a brief moment before you get sort of the next tidal wave coming and smacks you back down again in a good way, because it's just so full tilt the whole way through. The songs are all, I think the longest song is like 3 minutes, 50 seconds, which is about a minute longer than the second longest song. You know, they're tight, punchy songs that they get going and it doesn't let up.
All right. Well, I think you both like this. You too, Aoife?
Yeah, absolutely. He says himself he's trying to strip things back and you can really hear, like, you know, the building blocks of, you know, of 90s rock there, and he does it really, really well. Three and a half stars from
three and a half. And from you, Owen?
Yeah, I'm the same. Three and a half stars. It gets going. It doesn't really let up. You know, there's the only song that kind of at the end, the very last song, Your Side, is a beautiful song. If the first song is a punch in the face, then this is the sort of gentle kick in the nuts to finish the job at the end.
Well, Owen Glacken and Aoife Barry, thank you so much for listening to Mayhem by Lady Gaga. He's still talking. I can't stop him. Loner by Ramper and Here We Go Crazy from Bob Mould. That's it for tonight's show.